The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Nelson Mandela's given name, Holihlahla, literally means tugging at the branches of a tree. But at school, he was given the name of another famous leader.
When I went to school, the lady teacher, she says, "You are from today, you are going to be Nelson."
So henceforth, he would be known.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
Nelson Mandela woke up to freedom this morning in the spectacular surroundings of Bishop's Court, Archbishop Desmond Tutu's official residence on the slopes of Table Mountain. His wife Winnie at his side,
comrades,
the ANC leader appeared for the world's...
Out of the experience of an extraordinary human disaster that lasted too long, must be born a society of which all humanity will be proud.
Free Nelson Mandela. Oh, I'm begging you, free.
Mandela Day, the international celebration of the life and achievements of Nelson Mandela, falls today, the 18th of July. It's the first since he died, and if he'd lived, it would have marked his 96th birthday. The most famous African of his generation, he's widely regarded as the continent's greatest statesman, who is rightly garlanded with many awards from around the world. His legacy is almost too powerful for his successors to cope with, but is now much discussed. We'll be hearing the first audio interview with his widow, Graca Machel, and our Africa correspondent, David Smith, now reports from Johannesburg.
I'm standing beneath a statue of Nelson Mandela in Nelson Mandela Square, looking out at a hotel, library, theatre, water fountain, restaurants including the Hard Rock Cafe, and tourists taking photographs. This is Sandton, home to the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, and often described as the wealthiest square mile in Africa. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the national currency that changes hands here bears the face of Mandela. If I go south, I can take in a show at the Mandela Theatre, cross the Nelson Mandela Bridge, and visit the Mandela House in Soweto. South Africa's first black president died last December, but the melody lingers on, in statues, street names, and now a slew of books by his personal assistant, his prison warden, and his chief opponent in Parliament. Some might regard it as a cult of personality that, in a police state like North Korea, would be downright sinister. It's not something the anti-apartheid leader himself would have approved of. I spoke to people close to him in an attempt to separate the man from the myth. I started with the one who knew him best, his widow, Graca Machel, in her first interview since his death.
If you can imagine how millions of people felt this sense of loss, then you can imagine what it means for me. That huge presence, filling every detail of my life, full of him. And now, it's pain, it's emptiness. Actually, it's searching now who I am now after this experience. What am I going to do? And I'm still in that process, actually.
Children's issues are obviously a big concern of Mr. Mandela. I mean, do you see this as a way to continue his legacy, of course, including the children's hospital?
Definitely. Madiba had his heart was of the age of 95, if you like. But the inner him, the person he is, remained a child. He remained a child to the end. Even in the way he would... when he sees another child, because I'm saying another, he sees another child, his face would light up and big smile would come. And he will forget about everything else and his attention will be with that child. I think it is a lesson of life, of how a human being who had a journey like the one you know, who had gone through the most, trying kind of suffering, he remained a child to the end. And importantly, he reminded us, care for children.
And what are your happiest memories of your years with him?
Ever since you have seen me with Madiba, we always walk hand in hand. Whether it's in privacy, whether it was publicly, it was that kind of connection, of communication, which we had together. There was always a broad smile on his face. We shared so many moments of laughter. And that human connection is very, very special. And to be honest, this is what I miss now.
I'm at Love Books, a shop in Melville, Johannesburg. Looking at one of the shelves, I can see Mandela, the authorised portrait. Nelson Mandela, Conversations with Myself. Mandela by Martin Meredith. The Mandela Files. The Illustrated Long Walk to Freedom. Nelson Mandela by himself. The authorised biography by Anthony Sampson. As I walk across the room, I find Playing the Enemy by John Carlin and Knowing Mandela by John Carlin. Nelson Mandela has clearly become a publishing and cultural phenomenon, as well as a commercial franchise. I asked John Carlin if there's a danger of turning him into too much of a saint.
You know, with all these statues and street names, I think that what they show is actually, at one level, just how incredibly lucky South Africa is to have someone like Nelson Mandela as their beacon through time. There's very, very few countries that have a figure like Mandela that they can refer to, and to sort of restore their moral compass when their politicians become wayward. And that's a unique good fortune that South Africa has. But yes, to answer your question, I think there is a danger of gushing too much and placing him, you know, on a pedestal, rendering him almost superhuman, because the trouble with that is that you lose out on one critically important thing about Mandela, is that he is an example to be followed as a political leader. And if you elevate him so high that he just acquires a sort of mythical status, like someone out of, you know, Homer or something, then, you know, there's a risk. People say, well, that's just something, you know, no normal human being can aspire to.
As a journalist who got to know him over many years, in your mind, are you able to separate the man from the myth?
Well, you see, it is very difficult. I mean, I've written two books about Mandela, and, you know, the problem that I've had in the books that I've done, for example, is, you know, I find myself interviewing a man called Neil Barnard, who was head of the South African National Intelligence Service roughly between 1980 and 1994 or so. Therefore, was regarded at the time as one of the most evil and sinister human beings on the planet. And he always referred to him, not as Mandela or Madiba or whatever, he referred to him as the old man, as if he were talking about his dad or his granddad. And so what I found myself scrambling for, I suppose, is for the difficulties and failures and sadnesses and mistakes in his private life. He definitely screwed up fairly badly. People forget often that he had a wife before Winnie Mandela, Evelyn. She was a delightful, sweet lady. And often, how Mandela's life might have been if he had actually hadn't fallen for the bombshell Winnie. He was absolutely blown away by her. He was just, you know, he was thunderstruck at her beauty and charisma. And Evelyn was a much more feet on the ground kind of soul. And definitely there are, you know, some of his children recriminate him for having been father of the nation before being, you know, biological father. And he was, you know, a consummate political animal, biologically adapted to be that, to be a political leader. And there was that deficiency in him, that inability to deal at a sort of personal, emotional level with people. You know, he was always, in a way, on stage, playing a role, being the leader, being symbolic, being very affable in a public sort of way.
And it was Carlin's work, playing the enemy, Nelson Mandela, and the game that made a nation, that was made into the film Invictus, directed by Clint Eastwood. As Carlin notes, Mandela understood the power of symbols better than anyone. By wearing the Springbok jersey at the 1995 Rugby World Cup in South Africa, he bridged the racial divide and forged a new nation. Carlin's portrait seems to get close to Mandela, the flesh and blood individual. It is supported by the first-hand testimony of his former personal manager, Zelda Lakranji. Working for him transformed the Afrikaner from childhood racism under apartheid to becoming Mandela's closest aide. She says she wrote her book, Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, to tell the world about his humanity.
I think the world saw a lot of the politician and the strategist and so on, but I don't think the sensitive part, the humorous side of him, the teasing side, not the family man, but when he relaxed, what he enjoyed doing, I think that side is not so well known to the world. His kindness, you know, his meticulous attention to detail, those things, I don't think, you know, that's not part of an academic work. It's really my observations and the things that I know people would find interesting.
And obviously he's celebrated for reconciliation and forgiveness. I mean, did you gain an insight into where that came from with him? Was it in his nature, or was it purely a pragmatic choice to avoid a civil war?
No, it was really a part of his nature. And I think there's a lot of stories in the book that specifically deal with that, showing, you know, that even in everyday life and whenever he was in contact, how fair his mind was. He always had unity in mind and what was the best action to take in the smallest situations to bring about that reconciliation and that unity, forgiveness, how to really make people follow that and believe in it and that it was the right decision. So I think the book is one of hope and love, and you're talking about reconciliation now. First of all, it comes out very clear in the book that I had to reconcile with my past. I had to accept my past and make a decision, you know, obviously through his leadership, made a decision to change and how that has influenced my life rather.
Now, when you travel around South Africa and you see more and more statues of Nelson Mandela and streets named after him, is that strange to relate to the person you knew?
Yes, you know, it's not entirely what he wanted. I mean, he was never against him being honored in some way, but it's, you know, at some point, he always reminded us that there were many other people who were also part of the struggle, and those people need to be recognized. You know, if you ask a young person today who is Jane Singh, very few people can tell you. If you ask a young person who's Robert Sobukwe, very few people can really, you know, recite the history. And it was important to Madiba that those people are also remembered. So whilst it's great that people honour him in that way, they should remember that there's other people as well, and things can be named after other people as well. He was always also against unveiling his own statues, and you know, if it was an educational institution, he and there was really purpose for it to be named after him, he would agree to it. But he was also very careful that it doesn't become a spectacle, really.
And I believe he objected to this idea of being treated as a saint rather than as a flesh and blood human being.
You know, I've got the privilege of having hindsight over the past 19 years, and it's very interesting. I think we are partly responsible for that saint-like idea that we created around him. He was always the first to say, I'm a person with vices and virtues, and if you want me to call a saint is a sinner that keeps on trying. We want someone to aspire to, or something to aspire to. We want someone to look up to. So we've really, as human beings, we've chosen not to see his flaws. It's part of human nature, but he was always there to remind us, you know, that he's not a saint.
Okay, well, good evening, everybody. I know that amongst you tonight, there are people that possibly knew Nelson Mandela quite intimately and spent a large portion of their day with him. There are people who shared a brief moment with him, and there are people that maybe observed him from a distance, and there are people who just want to hear what it was like to be in the presence of this great man. And
it's wonderful to... We're at Love Books for the launch of yet another book of personal memories of Mandela, called Our Madiba, compiled by Melanie Vervoort. She's a former African National Congress MP, but that wasn't how her life started out.
I was born in the 60s, so I brought up and grew up being very much like any Afrikaans kid. Didn't have any contact with black people unless they were in a servant relationship. Got married very young, at 20, to a grandson of H.F. Vervoort, who was the prime minister, who's generally regarded as the architect of apartheid. We went abroad. There we met South African exiles and came back in 1990 after Mandela was released and met Nelson Mandela. And at the meeting, we wanted to apologize to him for the family's contribution. But he wouldn't actually allow us to do that. And he was just very insistent that we had a choice to make about how we used the fact that we carried a surname that people recognized and took notice of in South Africa. And so that set me on a journey and eventually completely changed my life. And I joined the ANC and became a member of parliament for the ANC. So for me, that is the extraordinary thing about this book, is the fact that people were telling me stories or writing stories about meetings that happened purely by chance. So there were no cameras, no spin doctors, no political gain to be made from it. And Madiba consistently reacted out of a position of love and care for the individual. And that, I think, is what South Africans are still paying tribute to.
Mandela himself was the first to say, you know, I'm not a saint. Mm. And actually, there were many great ANC leaders. It's not just about one man.
Yes, but we also need heroes in our lives. I think in our world, there are so few heroes around. Of course, Mandela wasn't a saint, and yes, and I also sometimes saw the temper and so on. But the fault lines were so few and far apart. I don't think we are yet eulogizing him or making him a saint. I think we just really love a man who was quite extraordinary.
20 years after the end of racial apartheid, white people are better off than ever. Half of young black people are jobless, and South Africa remains one of the most unequal societies in the world. Frustration is growing, and some say the nation faces a moment of reckoning. Mandela delivered political liberation, but could not deliver economic liberation. In an interview last year, Robert Mugabe, the president of Zimbabwe, described him as too much of a saint. It's a view that remains almost taboo in South Africa, but it's there. Did he make too many concessions to the white minority? Did he have the right to forgive on behalf of all black people? Did he give away the store? Mandela's defenders argue that he did what had to be done to build a constitutional, multi-party democracy. One man with the unenviable task of opposing him in parliament was Tony Leon, author of another new book, Opposite Mandela.
There's a lot of warmth and a lot of genuine interest. Mandela was a very curious man, and he was also usually brutally very candid, complete opposite of Mbeki, who was opaque and sort of secretive and suspicious. Mandela was, in that sense, almost the opposite. Now, obviously, I didn't know his inner secrets, but he would be brutally candid. But the other part is, you know, Mandela had an authoritarian streak to him, no doubt about it, and if you crossed him, as I did on a few things like that Shell House massacre, he really lost it, and he lost it with Buthelezi, and he threatened to cut off the money to Natal, did some fairly hairy things, said more than he did.
Was that like being sort of a headmaster or something?
Yeah, it was, but like that. The other thing was it almost happened, it was like turning on a dime. I mean, you know, you would one day have a good meeting, and he got so infuriated by these questions I was asking in Parliament and not accepting. I knew the answers were false about this shooting of all those Zulu marches in 1994. You know, you saw what a brilliant man, young man I was told, you know, all this nice flattery. He turned around and he said, you know what? He says, I know what you are. You're a young man who's trying to make an impression, but your party's all white. What has this got to do with the price of eggs? It was so, if you like, un-Mandela-esque, but there was that part as well. But for all that, and it was, but you know, there were a few moments like that where you crossed, you know, the sort of like Mount Vesuvius has exploded. You know. Those were the exceptions, not the rule. But a lot of Mandela's dazzling countenance and smile and warmth was reserved for outsiders. It's almost that he wanted the more outside you were, the more he needed to bring in. Whereas I think if you're an insider, it wasn't all, you know, moonshine and roses, because I think he was much, in a way, colder often to the people who were around him than those who were further away. That's what I understand.
Not only in politics, but even some of his own family members.
That's a point Stengel makes.
Yeah.
Both the people closest to him politically and in his family often did not experience the kind of the warmth and the embrace that those objects like me, who were so outside of his circle, enjoyed. Anyway, back to, but the truth about Mandela was, for all that, and there were, you know, my chapter called Blind Spots actually morphed into three chapters. I was going to talk about some other things. But for all that, David, I mean, Mandela's impulses generally were democratic. So it wasn't just that he was a, he took the form of Britain, which Mugabe certainly did, but he also embraced, you know, the idea of Britain. Rule of law, absolutely. Parliamentary accountability, pretty much in the main. And having a system that was not two states. I mean, you know, there was this whole debate going on last year, and then Stephen Ellis took it further when he died. You know, was he a communist? Well, he might have been, and he, no doubt at certain stages, was very close to Marxist Leninism, but he didn't govern as a communist. He didn't run a communist presidency, and he didn't behave like one in my interactions. You know, he was Stalinist. He wasn't like that at all.
I'm now outside Mandela's last home in Houghton, Johannesburg. It was here, on the 5th of December last year, that the man described by Barack Obama as a giant of history drew his final breath. Normally, the upmarket suburbs like this are deathly quiet after dark, with not a soul to be seen. But that night, I can remember arriving here just after midnight, and there was a growing crowd, black and white, singing songs, lighting candles, children in their pyjamas, who will remember it all their lives. South Africans just wanted to be here. It had been a long, slow decline, and Mandela's widow, Graça Machel, admits that in his twilight years she hid the news from him so as not to upset him. There is still plenty of bad news to hide from in South Africa today, as the current generation of political leaders try to live up to Mandela's legacy. And yet, this is a multiracial country with free elections, a boisterous media, and one of the best constitutions in the world. John Carlin argues that Mandela succeeded because he was a political realist who saved the nation from a civil war and recognised that all have a part to play in the new South Africa.
When I think of Mandela, one image that comes to mind is of a 19th century chairman of a gentleman's club. Great poise, great aplomb, great charm, but actually when it comes to the everyday business of dealing with your family, your wife, your friends, whatever, being actually sort of somewhat awkward. And maybe that's his Achilles heel.
There was an aura about Mandela that you felt before you even saw him. It's quite extraordinary. It was just simply a fact that when you were in his presence, you knew that you were in the presence of greatness. It's very hard to put your finger on exactly what it was. Charm, humor, self-deprecating humor, and a real sort of emotional outpouring of care. The fact that he was so interested in every individual he met, one of the authors said, he really felt like you were the only person that mattered in the world when he was speaking to you.
There was an entire wall of pictures of the former presidents of South Africa, the apartheid regime. There was a suggestion that they be removed because it's a part of history that not all people wanted to be reminded of. And Madiba said, no, leave them and don't remove them and don't replace them with only new leaders because it's part of history.
Zelda Lagrange, Nelson Mandela's personal manager, ending that report by David Smith. There's a full list of the books mentioned on the page to go with this podcast at theguardian.com/books. So please comment there, and why not subscribe to get our podcasts on a regular basis via iTunes or SoundCloud. We'd love to have you as part of our community. One of the successes of the state Mandela and his ANC comrades set up was to encourage the many South African expatriates to return. The situation is very different in East Africa, where countries such as Somalia and Ethiopia are still hemorrhaging many of their most talented children. Among them is the successful writer and journalist Dinah Mengistu, an Ethiopian now resident in the US, who won the Guardian's first book award in 2007 and 3 years later was named one of the New Yorker's 20 writers under 40. His most recent novel is about two young men who escaped their troubled land to Uganda. One stays in Kampala and the other travels on across the ocean, like Mengistu himself, to America. He began by reading a passage from All Our Names.
When Isaac and I first met at the university, we both pretended that the campus and the streets of the capital were as familiar to us as the dirt paths of the rural villages we had grown up and lived in until only a few months earlier, even though neither of us had ever been to a city before, and had no idea what it meant to live in such close proximity to so many people whose faces, much less names, we would never know. The capital in those days was booming, with people, money, new cars and newer buildings, most of which had been thrown up quickly after independence, in a rush fueled by ecstatic promises of a socialist Pan-African dream that almost 10 years later was still supposedly just around the corner, that according to the president and radio, was coming any day now. By the time Isaac and I arrived in the capital, many of the buildings had already begun to show signs of wear, having been neglected or completely forgotten. But there was still hope in the brighter future to come, and we were there like everyone else to claim our share. On the bus ride to the capital, I gave up all the names my parents had given me. I was almost 25, but by any measure, much younger. I shed those names just as our bus crossed the border into Uganda. We were closing in on Lake Victoria. I knew Kampala was close, but even then I had already committed myself to thinking of it only as the capital. Kampala was too small for what I imagined. That city belonged to Uganda, but the capital, as long as it was nameless, had no such allegiances. Like me, it belonged to no one and anyone could claim it. I spent my first few weeks in the capital trying to imitate the gangs of boys that lingered around the university and the cafes and bars that bordered it. Back then, all the boys our age wanted to be revolutionaries. On campus and in the poor quarters where Isaac and I lived, there were dozens of Lumumbas, Marleys, Malcolms, Cesares, Kenyattas, Senghoras, and Selassies. Boys who woke up every morning and donned the black hats and olive-green costumes of their heroes. I couldn't match them, so I let the few strands of hair on my chin grow long. I bought a used pair of green pants that I wore daily, even after the knees had split open. I tried to think of myself as a revolutionary in the making, though I'd come to the capital with other ambitions. A decade earlier, there had been an important gathering of African writers and scholars at the university. I read about it in a week-old newspaper that had finally made its way to our village. That conference gave shape to my adolescent ambitions, which until then consisted solely of leaving. I knew afterward where to go and what I wanted to be. A famous writer, surrounded by like-minded men in the heart of what had to be the continent's greatest city. I arrived in the capital poorly prepared. I had read the same Victorian novels a dozen times, and I assumed that was how proper English was still spoken. I said, "Sir," constantly. No one I met believed I was revolutionary, and I didn't have the heart to claim I wanted to be a writer. Until I met Isaac, I hadn't made a single friend. With my long, skinny legs and narrow face, he said I looked more like a professor than a fighter. And in the beginning, that was what he called me, Professor, or the Professor, the first but not the last name he christened me. "And what about you?" I asked him. I assumed that, like others, he had another, more public name that he wanted to be known by. He was shorter but wider than me, each of his arms tightly laced with muscles and veins that ran like scars the length of his forearms. He had the build, but not the face and demeanor of a soldier. He smiled and laughed too often for me to imagine he could ever hurt someone. "For now, Isaac is it," he said. Isaac was the name his parents had given him, and until it was necessary for us to flee the capital, the only name he wanted. His parents had died in the last round of fighting that came just before independence. Isaac was their legacy to him, And when his revolutionary's dream came to an end and he had to choose between leaving and staying, that name became his last and most precious gift to me.
Dina, it's a novel that has a historical setting, although I can see you've conflated several different events.
Correct. And the political movements that are happening in the backdrop are, they are a conflation of both Obote and Amin. And part of that desire is because, you know, we went from Obote to Amin back to Obote, and so the political and historical lines definitely blur on that regard.
You're using the word we. Now, you're Ethiopian. Your central character is, yes, Ethiopian, who goes to Uganda. You now live in New York. You teach in Washington. What does we mean?
I suppose I conflate myself within my characters, I guess, definitely to some degree. You know, the character in the novel comes to Kampala not because of its politics, but because of his own literary ambitions. And he comes there and learns about the country as a result of having arrived there almost as a new immigrant and with the ambitions of a writer, not of somebody who's investigating the history or the culture of the landscape. But at the same time, he does quickly become immersed in the place and in the politics and in the culture. And I suppose after the years of writing the novel, I see myself so deeply embedded in both of those characters.
There's a plot spoiler just bubbling away, yeah, under the surface there. But what we can say is that this is a novel of two halves, and your character arrives in the Midwest, in again a town with a fictitious name in the Midwest, right, into the arms of a social worker. And so you have this dual setting.
It was, you know, a chance for me to try to do something that I think my other novels had always one small foot in Africa and maybe more of a grounding in the United States. And this time I really, when I began the novel, I really thought the entire novel would take place in this imagined version of Kampala in the early 1970s. And as that story began to unfold, I realized that there was always this second half of the narrative that my imagination inevitably reverts to, and that, of course, is the United States. But unlike my previous works where I was exploring what happens to that sort of migrant when they come to the U.S., this was a chance to write about the point of view of an American who's actually sort of watching somebody come to the United States and deciding how to let that person into their home, into her heart, into her community. And so it became a different version of that conversation that happens with migration. Rather than telling the story from the point of view of somebody who arrives, it's from the point of view of the person who's always been there.
So you have in the American bit this quite hideous racism, and there's one particularly memorable, yeah, scene in a diner where you're aware that they could never actually live out in the open together. And this is presumably not the case now. It also is, yeah, a historical moment.
I wouldn't say we're completely past that moment. You know, part of what happens in that racist scene in the novel, and again, in this small town in the Midwest in the early 1970s, is the sort of language of racism has been sort of stripped away. So we don't sort of use the overt gestures of racial discrimination that were common throughout the 50s and 60s. There are no more signs that say no colored here. But in fact, it's the small gestures that reveal what the sort of true intent and the true heart of the people in the story. And I don't think we're that far away from that. I think oftentimes we may not have the overt racial discriminations, but you look at us and some of the rhetoric that follows the post-Obama era, and you can see very clearly those racial sentiments still lingering, and not that deep beneath the surface. They're sort of evident in the gestures once again, and again, the language has changed, but I don't think the sort of desire to express those sentiments has gone away at all.
And hand in hand with the issues of race, issues of class,
yeah,
and in both Uganda and in the States, you see students, there's an elite, a young, yeah, elite, who observed from the outside, this is not what our narrator is.
Yeah.
You could almost call it an anti-campus novel, part, yeah, of it is.
Yeah, it is. And in some ways, it, you know, sort of there's this sort of ways in which those narratives echo each other. There's the sort of persistent problem of racism that, you know, that happens in the United States. And in the scenes in Kampala, you have these young revolutionary students on this college campus who are also very much a product of the sort of privileged elite that comes into power after the post-colonial era. And so they perform the rhetoric of revolution, but in fact, oftentimes, it tends to be the sort of poorer people who end up fighting those battles on their behalf.
And we've seen these characters in your previous novels, this extraordinary listlessness and exclusion.
I'm always drawn to the people on the margins, the two young men on this college campus who go to this campus because they have these sort of ambitions to be a part of this community are very much clearly isolated from it because of their status as very sort of poor people. Their economic status keeps them on the outside. And in Children of the Revolution, it was this very similar situation where you have these three African men in the United States who are very much on the margins, not always economically, but definitely because of the color of their skin, the fact that they're migrants, that they haven't really found their place in the United States, keeps them outside of the sort of traditional norms of behavior. And Helen, even though she's a sort of white social worker in the Midwest, also is slightly on the outside. She's somebody who hasn't adapted to the sort of expectations of what a woman her age is supposed to do. She doesn't have a family. She doesn't have a husband. She has set herself apart from her normal society and instead actually has a relationship with a young African man.
There are a couple of lines here which I was really struck by, which seemed to me to lie at the heart of it. Rescue, that is the true heart behind romance and fairy tale, the spontaneous love that frees us from the tower, hospital bed or broken world is always only the means to that end.
It's sort of the narrator talking about his own sort of broken body in this hospital and the idea of the images that he imagines will save him. And he attaches that sort of fairy tale narrative of that you sort of find love and the love will be the thing that saves you. But in fact, in his position at that moment, the love is actually secondary to the desire to sort of be free. He is eventually actually rescued. You know, that idea of rescue does actually come into play for him. But it does come with a great sort of sacrifice that somebody makes on his behalf.
The other line that I was very interested by was this recurrent image of him being the writer, him being a writer and a map maker.
Yeah.
He witnesses a massacre in a tiny village too small to exist on maps.
Yeah.
And what he does is he makes a map of it. And he says, I drew a map of the route. I recorded every bend in the road and the few folks that I came upon, along with sketches of a few long abandoned thatch roofed homes, barely visible from the path. It was far from poetry, less than a journal and worthless as history.
Yeah.
That's a ringing phrase.
I think that's part of the anxiety all writers have is and definitely a reflection of, I think, the anxiety that I've experienced as a journalist. And I remember very clearly writing that particular line in passage and thinking of this village that I'd recently spent time in Eastern Congo that had been pillaged over and over, the sort of deep desire for the people in that village to have me tell their story. You know, they felt like as long as I was telling their story, somebody would listen to it and that would provoke a response. And at the same time, you know very clearly that you will write about it, but the response is not guaranteed, that this narrative that you have invested yourself in and that you may try to sort of accurately report on might not actually have any consequence other than the fact that you've experienced it. And the narrator's sentiment in that moment is very much, I think, a reflection of that.
That what I really want to know is, what is the difference between this novel and your journalism?
I always come back to this beautiful quote from Marilyn Robinson's novel Housekeeping, where she says, facts tell us nothing. If anything, it's facts that need explaining. And, you know, the sort of nonfiction work that I do does at times try to lay out the facts so people can understand the sort of sequence of events that happen. But I think what you try for as a novelist is to invest characters and readers with the experience of what's happened and allows you to sort of linger in a more complicated space. So you're less concerned with the sort of actual political machinations of any one particular place at one particular moment and more with the long-term consequences of what those political, economic, historical violence does to a community, to a person.
Dina Mengestu's All Our Names is published in Britain by Scepter. Thanks to him and to all who took part in David Smith's South African update. We'll be staying in Africa next week for a book club featuring the award-winning Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She'll be discussing her transatlantic novel, Americana. That, by the way, is what Nigerians call those who've spent a lot of time in the US. I'm Claire Armistead and my producer colleague is Tim Mabey. From both of us, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With summer here, you've finally got the time to relax, listen to all those Guardian podcasts you might have missed,
And while you're listening, you'll also have time to build that website you've always wanted for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or your blog. With Squarespace, it's easier than you think, and getting started takes only seconds. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.